Well, it's just flat out nonsense. Egg yolks have long been maligned because of this cholesterol content, but cholesterol doesn't cause heart disease. LDL, which is a carrier of cholesterol, people think it's a type of cholesterol, but actually it's a little, you know, truck that carries cholesterol around in the bloodstream. It does have a role in heart disease, but it has a role in heart disease when it is oxidized. Oxidized LDL is going to be the new buzzword in terms of looking at heart disease. We know that high homocysteine and highly sensitive C-reactive protein are much more accurate markers for both the development and the acceleration of heart disease in the body. So don't let anybody tell you that your cholesterol is too high. You know, America has a lower cholesterol than lots of countries. Switzerland always wins the award as the highest cholesterol in the world, with a third less heart disease than we have here. The Australian Aborigines have the lowest cholesterol in the world, and they have one of the highest heart disease rates in the world. But when we look at cholesterol, LDL cholesterol, which people often refer to as the bad or the lousy cholesterol, really only becomes dangerous when it's oxidized. Oxidized cholesterol produces inflammation in the arteries. And so when we're supplying the blood to our organs and tissues, all those arterial supply lines can get inflamed. And that's what increases our risk of heart attack or stroke. LDL oxidizes when these particles in your body react with free radicals. Now, you know what a free radical is. I know you do, because you listen to No Nonsense Nutrition on a regular basis. And you know that free radicals are thieves. They're trying to steal electrons off of another molecule. And so they become highly reactive. You know, I steal an electron from you and you steal it from the next person, and that's how you create a free radical cascade. And those are unstable molecules, and that's what produces tissue damage when the LDL becomes more reactive with the surrounding tissue. So if we smoke cigarettes, if we have a diet that's high in trans fats, you know, trans fats are these molecules that have been altered in order to make them more stable. So you go ahead and get sunflower oil, safflower oil, corn oil, and you put it in a big vat of thousands of gallons of stuff, and you run hydrogen gas through there. And the hydrogen gas causes the molecule to twist in a funny way. It's called a cis molecule. Or a trans molecule, it alters the shape of it. Well, remember the fundamental law in chemistry. You change the shape of a molecule, you change the function of a molecule. That's the reason that natural and synthetic aren't the same. I was on the phone with a client on Saturday who's received a pesticide poisoning. And she received a pesticide poisoning because the pesticide people said, oh, this is the same chemical that's in chrysanthemums. It's absolutely safe. But the pest control people lied to her. But furthermore, there is a difference between a pyrethrin and a pyrethroid. Pyrethrins occur naturally in a chrysanthemum, and yes, they are an insect repellent and insecticide. But pyrethroids are a created chemical in a laboratory, and they're neurotoxic in their effect. And so this woman had her house sprayed with pyrethroids, and she ended up with liver damage as a result of it. So again, you change the shape of a molecule, you change the function of the molecule. You change a pyrethrin to a pyrethroid, you change a fat to a trans fat. Any of these alterations can cause problems. And so what increases the level of oxidized LDL is if you have a diet high in trans fats. And that's a lot of bakery goods. You know, when I leave the station here on Monday morning, I often drive down Central Avenue and Main Street, as it were, in Sarasota, and go by one of the bakeries that sometimes has a line outside the door. A lot of trans fats are going to show up in baked goods. So whether it's smoking or a diet high in trans fats or poorly controlled diabetes, which I only see about three times a day in my practice, people that have metabolic syndrome, People that have insulin resistance, people that have high triglycerides, these are situations that contribute to oxidizing LDL. When the LDL becomes oxidized, it goes directly inside the endothelium, the inner lining of any artery in the body, including the carotid artery or the coronary artery, or the arteries that supply your arms and legs with blood. It just becomes exactly the perfect size and the perfect shape to slip underneath that lining. And once it's there, it encourages inflammatory cells to accumulate at that site. It encourages platelets to adhere in that damaged area. So it creates a domino cascade. Once you pull these white blood cells in there, these inflammatory cells, and then the platelets come in, and then more cholesterol comes in, and other lipids accumulate at the site, that's how you form a plaque inside the artery that begins to grow thicker. And over time, this can, well, it can completely restrict the blood flow that travels to your body. It can result in a variety of health conditions, anything from coronary heart disease to peripheral vascular disease to dementia. So the cholesterol that's dangerous is oxidized LDL. We don't even know if HDL is that protective. There's a lot of discussion among both the conventional scientific community and the holistic medical community about how much protection HDL, the happy cholesterol, actually does. But we know that LDL by itself isn't bad. It's oxidized LDL. And over the next couple of years, you're going to see it show up more on the blood panels. Right now, you have to ask for it. So what's the first thing you can do to stop oxidized LDL? It isn't stopping eating egg yolks, that's for sure. It's to stop smoking. It's to exclude trans fats from your diet. It's the pastries, the deep fried food, the potato chips, and the foods cooked in lard. There's your list right there of the things that are going to contribute to oxidized LDL. Now, the more fruits and vegetables that you have in your diet, the more antioxidants you have in your diet. And the more antioxidants you have, the greater the anti-inflammatory properties, the less free radicals that happen. So we reduce the oxidation of LDL with fruits and vegetables in the diet. We reduce it with vitamin E. This is the place that vitamin E wins. And so when we eat whole grains, seeds, and nuts, the primary sources of vitamin E, well, of course, other than egg yolks, because we definitely get not a whole lot, maybe a milligram of vitamin E, but I guarantee you it's better than nothing. So stop smoking, get rid of the trans fats, eat more fruits and vegetables, and take vitamin E. And those are things that you can do to stop oxidized LDL. But stopping egg yolks isn't going to do it, because egg yolks do not cause heart disease. They're actually good for your heart. University of Connecticut has done extensive studies on the effect of eggs on cholesterol level. And they found out that when people consumed 4 eggs a day with the yolk, that virtually everybody experienced either no change or beneficial changes in their cholesterol. Well, what are the beneficial changes? They actually change the size of the LDL. And so we've got little LDLs and big LDLs, and the big LDLs are protective. And so there's plenty of safety when it comes to eating egg yolks, and we've been able to prove it. Plus, egg yolks would resolve Americans' most common nutrient deficiencies. Now, for those of you out there who have insomnia, I have a report for you to read. It's from the, get ready, just wait, hold on, the Interagency Board for Nutrition Monitoring and Related Research of the Federation of American Societies for Experimental Biology Life Science Research Office. Yeah, and I did it on one breath. Now, the executive summary of that report on nutrition monitoring in the United States says almost everybody is deficient in magnesium. You know, magnesium is involved in about 300 different processes in the body, and we just flat out don't get enough magnesium. Here's a situation where we do get something from the white of the egg, because about 80% of the magnesium we get comes from the white of the egg, about 3 or 4 milligrams. But almost everybody is deficient in magnesium. So if you're somebody and you get leg cramps or you have heart palpitations or you have a twitch in your eye, you probably are low in magnesium. A number of groups, and you have to remember, they study children 1 to 2 and then children 4 to 10 and then children 10 to 16 and like that. So there's various groups. A number of groups have a deficient intake of calcium. You'd think America was deficient in calcium with all the calcium supplements that get hustled, but in fact, America is one of the four countries in the world that eats the most calcium. But we still have groups that are deficient. We're going to get calcium out of an egg, too. Same deal. We don't get a lot, but we get some. And so the nature of that, calcium comes exclusively out of the yolk. About 20 to 25 milligrams of calcium comes out of every egg yolk we eat. We know that little kids, kids that are 1 and 2 years old, and almost all females are deficient in their intake in iron. And this isn't just menstruating women. I mean, it starts at age 1 or 2. So you moms out there that are nursing, you want to make sure that your iron levels are really good so your milk has good iron levels. And you want to make sure if you're feeding your child formula, and I hope you're feeding them organic formula because the four major formulas that are sold in the United States are all made with genetically engineered corn. We don't even know what that's going to do to kids. They need iron. Well, guess what eggs have in them? Eggs have a little bit of iron. Yeah, it's about a half a milligram, and we get some of it from the white and some of it from the yolk. But we got to get that egg yolks alone can resolve nutritional deficiencies. Blacks over the age of 16 and Mexican Americans over the age of 60 almost always have a deficiency of folic acid or folate. Now, I bet you guessed. There's folate in an egg. In fact, 25 micrograms show up in the yolk. There's barely a microgram in the white, but 25 micrograms, 95% of all the folate comes to us from an egg yolk. Every age group and every race had a deficient median intake of vitamin A, vitamin E, B6, and copper. Now, when we look at these fat-soluble vitamins like vitamin A, vitamin E, vitamin D, vitamin K, every bit of it comes from the yolk. There's none of those fat-soluble vitamins that exist in the white of the egg. And, you know, with vitamin A, we talk about beta-carotene here on No Nonsense Nutrition on a regular basis. It's that orangey, goldy, reddish pigment that we find, not just in carrots, but in cantaloupe and papaya and apricots and in broccoli. No, you don't see that yellow color in broccoli because the chlorophyll covers it up. But beta-carotene is a fabulous carotenoid. And if you have a deficiency of vitamin A, it will convert into vitamin A in your body. So beta-carotene isn't really vitamin A. It's called provitamin A. But it's the source that you can have for vitamin A. Whole vitamin A that's already vitamin A, we don't have very good sources for it. Egg yolks are one of the best sources. And not only is vitamin A an eyesight vitamin, it keeps you from getting night blindness. If you go out to drive at night and the headlights are woogie, and you know that's a very scientific term, woogie, they're not quite in focus. They're a little bit blurry. You're one of the people that you go to the movie theater and it takes a really long time for you to adjust to the dark. Then likely you've got a vitamin A deficiency. Vitamin A is also a skin vitamin. If you've got eczema or psoriasis or acne, if you've got rashes or dry spots, the likelihood is that you're deficient in vitamin A. So if all age groups and all races have a deficient median intake of vitamin A, well, getting some egg yolks in your diet is a good way to solve that problem. There's about 250 IUs, international units. Remember, when you measure fat-soluble vitamins, you measure them in IUs, international units. You don't measure them in MGs or MCGs, milligrams or micrograms. Milligrams or micrograms are measurements that we use for water-soluble vitamins like vitamin C and vitamin B. We also found out that all age groups were low in vitamin E. And even though there's barely a milligram of vitamin E in a single egg, for some people, they have no other sources of vitamin E. You know, when you read what the Shute brothers did up in Canada and their research on vitamin E and heart disease, you'd be taking
vaccines that stimulate the immune system. So they stimulate even more immune reactivity. So there's this convergence of things that will then cause the pancreas to just stop making insulin. The beta cells will go away. Type 2 diabetes is a metabolic phenomenon that happens as the body deals with insulin and calorie load and tries to adapt. It adapts by putting fat into cells, and as the cells get more and more fat, they become less and less interested in hearing the message that insulin is telling them to put more fat in their cells, to take up the sugar and turn it to fat. And as that goes on, the pancreas puts out more and more and more insulin to get the cells in the body to listen, and eventually the sugar begins to rise in the blood as the availability of insulin kind of peaks and the cells continue to stop listening to it. And so at that point, late in the disease, blood sugar will rise. Prior to that, though, insulin levels are already rising and causing inflammation and high blood pressure and all kinds of damage to the blood vessel system. And in the meantime, the pancreas is getting tired. It only has so much metabolism that it can do, and eventually it will stop making insulin.
So essentially what's happening is the pancreas is ending up doing in 50 years what it was designed to do in 80 years.
Exactly. So that's the difference between type 1 and type 2. Type 1 is an inflammatory autoimmune destruction of the pancreas. Type 2 is a failing of the body to actually be able to listen to insulin and use it right.
And that's why we want to tip our hat to the groups that encourage breastfeeding here in Sarasota. We have several groups that are supporting women who are breastfeeding. And we want to give a special tip of the hat to the show here on WSLR, Maternally Yours, who is helping mothers understand that there is nothing better for that baby under 12 months old, especially, than breast milk, because mothers have an awful time when they look at the alternatives to that, because absolutely we don't want to be putting other mammal milk in these babies under 12 months old. But the four major formulas that are out there in the marketplace are all made with genetically engineered corn and genetically engineered soybeans. So we don't know what happens when we feed babies these infant formulas during the first year. We don't know what kind of problems that's going to create. So mamas, you want to keep that baby on that breast for at least the first 12 months. It really is an amazing difference that it makes for your child in terms of a big jump on their health for the rest of their lives. But you know what I see, Dr. Harvey, is the number of clients that come in and say, I'm pre-diabetic.
Right.
Let's talk about what does pre-diabetic mean.
Pre-diabetic means you're in trouble. Pre-diabetic means you are at risk for developing all of the complications of diabetes, because pre-diabetes really is diabetes.
And so what I say to clients is, have you ever heard of anybody being sort of pregnant?
Exactly.
And so it's the same thing. Pre-diabetes is sort of diabetes.
Yes. It's just not the case. It really is the problem. It's suggested that 2/3 of all heart attacks that occur in the United States occur in pre-diabetic individuals. So the vascular problem that diabetes causes is already occurring before. See, the thing is, the pre-diabetic state is simply diabetes not declared. It declares itself when the sugar finally goes above what's considered, quotes, normal. But we found out that even what we've considered normal is not, quotes, normal. Blood sugar over 87 fasting in the morning suggests that you're at risk for developing full-blown diabetes in the future.
Well, I think one of the first things we have to do is to do the right tests. And just with the tests that you have currently, there is a ratio that is very important and is overlooked by most physicians. And that is the ratio between your HDL, or the happy cholesterol as it's often called, the good cholesterol. Think of the LDL as the lousy cholesterol, and the HDL is the happy cholesterol. If we take your triglyceride number, and your triglycerides are these fats that are floating around in your bloodstream that your heart can use for fuel, that your brain can use for fuel, and sometimes your cell can use for fuel. And if you take that triglyceride number and you divide it by your HDL, What we're doing is we're looking at that number and realizing that when that number is above 4, we're diabetic. And when that number is at 3.5, we're headed toward diabetes. We absolutely want that ratio between the HDL and the triglycerides to be less than 3. And so you take your triglyceride number, which absolutely should be below 100, and you take your HDL and you divide the triglycerides by the HDL. And that's one of the warning signs that we can have that we're headed toward diabetes. The second test that we can look at is something called hemoglobin A1C. Hemoglobin A1C does not measure what your glucose is today. It measures how good your body has controlled your glucose over the last couple of months. So instead of just having that static snapshot of what your blood glucose is when they pull the needle out of your arm, we're looking at a longer duration of blood sugar control. And the third thing is something called fasting insulin. When you get a fasting glucose test, you can also get a fasting insulin test. And we know now that when that fasting insulin test starts going up into double digits, 10, 11, 12, 15, 17, 21, whatever, that we're also on the very strong road to being in failure of the body to control blood sugar exquisitely. So not just knowing about this, but knowing the right test to look at. And those are three things that you can often get cooperation from your physician in terms of testing. There are other things that are a little bit more esoteric in terms of testing, something called a 2-hour postprandial glucose insulin challenge.
Yes, many doctors do the glucose tolerance test. And from my perspective, I think, and from Eve's, they do it wrongly because they neglect during the post challenge period, when you get the sugar soda and go on, they neglect to get an insulin. They get the sugars, but so if anybody is thinking of asking their doctor for a glucose tolerance test or has been recommended, ask that they order also an insulin level on the follow-up, the 2-hour.
Yeah, no question about it. But I have a hard time getting docs to do that, but I don't have a hard time getting docs to do the fasting insulin or looking at the hemoglobin A1C.
Right.
We want that hemoglobin A1C absolutely positively below 5.7. When you look at a lot of the scores, it says that if you have a 7 on a hemoglobin A1C, you're diabetic. But the thing is, if you have any numbers in the 6s, even looking at 5.9s,
yes,
you're in a position where it's on the horizon. So I look at nutrients, Dr. Harvey, and it isn't just a matter of skipping dessert. You know, I had a client that came in to me a week ago, and she said, well, what's the best for me to do? Should I do an Atkins diet or an Ornish diet or a Weight Watchers diet or a Zone diet or a South Beach diet? And I said, what's true is that I'm just delighted that you're thinking about it.
Yes.
Because the fact that you're thinking about it means that you're starting to pay more attention to what you eat, and that's the place we have to go. And so I'm going to use the same axiom that I've used in 30 years in practice. Eat what occurs in nature. If it comes out of a bag or a box or a frozen container, the likelihood is it's a long way away from nature. You don't need a PhD in nutritional biochemistry to tell the difference between a chicken and a chicken nugget or a potato and a Pringle. Look at what occurs in nature. That's the first step. So yeah, you can still make mistakes that way, but you can make a lot fewer of them.
This is very true. I like the idea of eating close to nature because really, it's hard sometimes to read labels because you don't understand the words. It's best just to avoid them then. If the word has more than 4 or 5 syllables and it's in techno-speak or Latin, it's probably not something you want to put between your lips unless the Latin's on a single herb remedy that you found at the health food store. But otherwise, you really want to be looking for stuff that's just in its original packaging.
I talked on the show a couple of months ago. I found a bag of potato chips that had 22 ingredients.
Oh my.
You know, you'd think in potato chips it would be potato and oil and salt, and that would be it. And there was 22 ingredients because they were barbecued flavored. And the thing I remember growing up that was great about barbecued flavored potato chips is when you were done eating them, you could always use your fingers for eyeshadow. So one of the rules that I have is to make sure that people eat within an hour of arising and make sure they eat protein in their breakfast meal. So whether you're going to have eggs or whether you're going to have a salmon patty or a chicken sausage or you're going to have some Greek yogurt like I've got on my fruit this morning, the idea is to get protein into you within an hour of arising. If you start out in the morning with a piece of toast and jelly, a bowl of sugar bombs, a cheese Danish, when you start out in the morning with something that's pure carb, you poke that pancreas in the side and you get it to produce wrongly, literally throughout the day. And so I'll have individuals who say, if I eat first thing in the morning, I'm just eating all day long. I just can't stop my hunger. Eat protein first thing in the morning and you'll find out that that will change.
It really does. And protein with fiber is really good because it'll actually last you even longer. Having a bowl of fruit with your Greek yogurt is really a great idea. Having eggs with some spinach in, again, a nice combination of fiber and greens, and protein. You got to start the day with protein because in the morning, all of your food-finding hormones spike. You have adrenaline go up. You have cortisol go up. Your body's looking to put calories in, but it's not looking specifically for sugar because cortisol is already mobilizing sugar in your body and adrenaline is already mobilizing sugar in your body. So you need to add protein so you can actually shore up what the body is already doing.
Well, and, you know, I try to get half of every plate of food to be vegetables at lunch and dinner.
Yes.
And so looking at that client last week that was eating all of those carb calories from flour, simply asking her that when she had her roast beef sandwich to put coleslaw on the side. You know, when she had that flour-based meal, adding something to it. Oftentimes with people, it's smarter to ask them to add something than it is to take away what's familiar. Mm-hmm. And so when I said, well, what about some coleslaw together with the roast beef sandwich? She said, I couldn't eat that much. I said, well, then have a half a roast beef sandwich in the coleslaw.
Very good, because actually that extra sat fat in the roast beef is something that will contribute to more diabetic problems.
But it's not time for her to make that leap yet.
Right.
For her, just adding those vegetables on the side of the plate is a big move.
Mm-hmm.
So when I look at the way that we can treat this, the other thing that I look at is stopping the calories that come from liquids. You know, when people are drinking diet soda, you know I've been on a campaign for 20 years to get people to understand that, number one, diet soda has not caused America to lose 1 ounce, but it has caused America to lose a lot of bone.
That's
and it's
sure.
The phosphoric acid in those dark colored sodas, whether they're diet sodas or not diet sodas, that is one of the big eroders of bone. And when I look at calories that are liquid, I'm talking about juices, soda, macchiato, espresso, banana,
super frozen caramel,
but only
$2 in the afternoon if you come in the morning. And
all those fancy drinks that are extra calories. And so, yes, it's the cocktails. Yes, it's the glass of wine. Yes, it's the soda pop. Yes, it's the juice. All of those things, when you take out the liquid calories, unless it's a protein shake, then you're going to be in a situation where you're going to have a lot better way of controlling your blood sugar.
You know, there's one that actually doesn't show up on a lot of men's radar, and that's Gatorade. They don't think of it. They think of it as a...
Well, it's sports drinks in general.
But the Gatorade, they think of as a sports hydration drink. And so it's really not something good for... It may be good for hydration, but it's full of sugar. It's full of high fructose corn syrup, and they miss those calories. They don't realize that they're getting that extra inundation.
Well, when we begin to look at making those changes, you know, I advise people to eat every 4 to 5.5 hours. As soon as you go longer than 4 to 5.5 hours between meals, then you're in a place that everything looks good.
Yes.
The first thing that you eat is the first thing you can reach for. And
right.
So people need to plan their meals. And I'm still simply amazed at the number of clients that come into the clinic when I say, what are you having for dinner tonight? And they go, I don't know. What are you having for lunch today? Well, I don't know. And it's hard for me to comprehend, because I think that we should know ahead of time what's planned for tonight. So I may go to the market after this radio show, but I know on Monday night I always cook a piece of fish. So, you know, I've got bok choy in the vegetable bin. I've got a sweet potato on the counter. So, you know, I already know part of what my meal is going to be, even though I don't know what fish I'm going to buy today.
You know, two things that can lead into. One is that every 4 to 5 hours, because you'll be hungry by then. At 8 hours, you're starving, you're famished, ravenous. But every one or two hours, some people graze all day. And that actually increases central obesity.
Five people of choline, they end up developing fatty liver. And, you know, we're seeing an epidemic of non-alcoholic fatty liver in this country. And, you know, fatty liver, we've usually seen in alcoholics. You know those, the old skinny drunks, the ones they turn from the back, they look really lean, they've got little bony bird legs, and then they turn sideways and it looks like they put a basketball underneath their shirt. Most often, this is fatty liver from alcoholism. But a non-alcoholic fatty liver is really an epidemic in this country, and we're seeing a relationship between non-alcoholic fatty liver and diabetes, and between non-alcoholic fatty liver and sleep apnea. And right now, we don't know what comes first. Do we get diabetes, and that gives us a fatty liver, and that makes us have apnea, or do we get apnea, and that, you see where the question is. You know, not all of these things we have in ink. But what we do know is that when we deprive people of dietary choline, they develop fatty liver or they develop muscle damage, and they do it in 6 weeks. So, personally, I don't want to eat beef liver. I don't want to eat liver of any animal, because liver is one of the places that the greatest concentration of toxins occur. And that's the other rich source of choline. So when we're looking for an egg breakfast, we're actually looking for things that help us lose weight. There was a beautiful controlled study that was done with 160 people that were divided into two groups, and they kept them for 8 weeks on a 1,000-calorie-reduced diet. I don't mean a 1,000-calorie diet. I mean 1,000 calories less than what their body needed. And there was only one difference in the diet, and that was at the breakfast. And one half of the people, 80 of the people, got two eggs for breakfast every single solitary morning. And the other group had a bagel for breakfast every single solitary morning. They had exactly the same amount of calories in the bagel and in the two eggs, and they exactly had the same amount of weight mass. They're starting to understand that the actual amount that the breakfast weighs is a control factor in how full you feel. So these people were on this special diet for 8 weeks, two eggs or a bagel, all the rest of the calories the same. Well, guess what happened? The people that ate the egg lost twice as much weight. The egg eaters lost an average of 6 pounds over the 8 weeks, and the bagel eaters lost 3.5 pounds. But moreover, the egg eaters had a greater decrease in waist circumference and reported a greater increase in energy. Are you liking egg yolks yet? We don't care about the cholesterol. We care about the choline. We care about the folic acid. We care about the rest of these great nutrients that are in there. We care about the lutein that's going to protect our eyes. We care about the zeaxanthin that's going to protect our eyes. University of Massachusetts did a study, and they were comparing eggs to breakfast cereal. And what they were doing is measuring the blood levels of lutein and zeaxanthin. And it turns out that when they gave the people eggs every day, not only did their cholesterol not go up, their triglycerides did not go up, but they gained a tremendous amount of antioxidant carotenoid in the eyeball. Now, I don't know how you measure macular pigment optical density. Until I read this study, I actually never heard of MOPD, macular pigment optical density. But in this 12-week intervention, they found out that they greatly increased the density or the amount of this lutein and zeaxanthin that were in the eye by 26 and 38%. So it appears that the daily egg truly offers protection against age-related macular degeneration. And if you're not going to have it for breakfast, then an egg salad sandwich for lunch sounds pretty good. You know, I've got a client right now, and she's making muffins every morning. I talked to her on the phone this week. It's one of my clients that lives in a northern state. And she's always so busy, and she's always rushing out the door in the morning. And I said, well, take a muffin tin and put in the bottom of each one of those tins the things that you would put in an omelet. You know, a little sautéed onion, a little mushroom, a scoop of salsa, a little bit of cheese, you know, a leftover piece of salmon, you know, whatever it is you got. And then scramble your egg and put your egg into the muffin cup. And when you do that, put it in a 325-degree oven, and it cooks in about 8 to 12 minutes, depending on whether you got the great big fat muffin cups where the egg isn't very thick, or you got the old-fashioned small muffin cups. And now you've got your egg muffins made for the next couple of days. And then all you have to do is just pop a couple of those into a Ziploc bag, and with those you can just rock on. Walk out the door with your egg muffin. You know, there's plenty of myths about eggs. I heard that if the shell of a fresh egg is smooth and it's uncracked, it's safe to eat raw. I don't think any eggs are safe to eat raw. It doesn't mean that they do terrible things to you, but salmonella germs show up in 50% of the eggs. Food and Drug Administration confirms this. But, you know, you never want to eat an egg with a crack in it, because once the egg is cracked, the bacteria from the environment can enter into them. Some people think if they wash their eggs, they'll be safe, but it doesn't work, because the salmonella bacteria sometimes is inside the egg. So I still don't think raw eggs are safe. I heard from a client one time that you could pasteurize fresh eggs at home in a microwave. Sorry. You can't make raw or undercooked eggs safe from salmonella as a do-it-yourself job. The United States Department of Agriculture says that the equipment that's used to pasteurize egg isn't available for home use. So when you buy eggs in a, you know, essentially a milk carton as pasteurized eggs, it's not something that's a do-at-home project. I heard from somebody one time that brown eggs don't have salmonella and organic eggs don't have salmonella, but organic means that the no pesticides, herbicides, and fungicides are used on the feed that are given to those particular hens. You know, brown eggs just relate to the breed of hen. So, you know, back in 2009, there was even a recall of organic eggs because of salmonella. So I want to remind you that, you know, the salmonella issue with eggs is the biggest threat with eggs. It isn't the egg yolks affecting heart disease. You know, some people think that eggs from a local farm are safer than those from a grocery store. But guess what? The eggs in the grocery store come from a farm too. You just don't see the farm. And so, you know, trustworthy local farmers that you know personally, we still have to know that salmonella is prevalent in a bigger proportion of chickens in this country than it isn't. Cage-free doesn't mean anything in terms of a salmonella exposure. You know, bacteria are natural, just like farms. Dangerous bacteria exist on all farms and, of course, on the bottom of women's pocketbooks. Between the rodents and the flies and the dust and the other birds, even free-range hens on a farm can be exposed to salmonella. So all types of eggs, it doesn't matter if they're organic or brown, are included in the egg safety rule. You know, I 30 years in practice, you hear a lot of stories. And I can remember somebody telling me one time that the only way that you could get sick from an egg is if it smelled bad. But guess what? Salmonella doesn't have an odor in any amount. So when we begin to look at some of these myths that are talked about in terms of eggs, I just want you to eat eggs, and I just want you to eat egg yolks. And even if you throw away the white, you know what? I'm not going to care. because it's the egg yolk that's really got the benefit for you. Please remember, when you read a headline about something dastardly happening with food, that you probably need to read the whole study, or you probably need to pick up the phone and call us here at the station at 894-6469. Leave a message for me about what this new terrible threat is that's happening, like egg yolks.